Are we about tasks or learning? How do our beliefs about assessment shape absolutely everything we do? How has it become acceptable to do nothing in a classroom, and what can we do about it? Welcome back to another episode of the Teachers on Fire podcast, airing live on YouTube every Saturday morning at 8 a.m. Pacific and 11 a.m. Eastern. My name is Tim Cavey, and my mission here is to warm your heart, spark your thinking, and ignite your professional practice. Today's Teacher on Fire is Melissa Dean. Melissa is a high school math, science, and ELA teacher who is passionate about reforming assessment and reimagining mathematics education. She is a developing inquiry and design thinking teacher who is constantly in reflection about her teaching practice and the state of education. She's also the author of Unravel School, Reimagine Classrooms, Reinvent Assessment, and Revive Learning. You can follow Melissa on X and Instagram at dean_of_math and on her website at deanofmath.wordpress.com. Melissa, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Are you ready to light it up?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
That's the kind of answer I like to hear. Before we get into your work and mission, Melissa, let's dig into your story. Tell us about a low moment or an experience of adversity that you've faced somewhere in your teaching or education journey, and describe how you overcame it.
When I think about the last 20 years of teaching, really the low moment came, the most pivotal low moment came early in my career, about 4 or 5 years in, and I found myself tasked with teaching grade 8 math, and I had hoped to never deal with math ever again after my experience as a student. Did university math because I took a science degree. I never intended to be a teacher of math, and found myself standing in front of a classroom teaching math the way I had been taught, and I looked out at my students' faces. And the look on their faces so mirrored what I had experienced as a student and the look that must have been on my face. And I just, like, my heart just sank. I just realized I was teaching the way I was taught, and the way I was taught didn't work for me. And that made me think that there might be other people out there that it doesn't work for either. And so that actually is what sparked my whole journey towards becoming a mathematics educator and really diving into the teaching of math and understanding math in a new way. So it was low. It was a low point in my teaching journey, absolutely, because it was just so disheartening and so it was a revelation to me about how my students were feeling, because I could see it on their faces physically. But at the same time, while it's a low point, it's absolutely what sparked my journey towards where I am right now. So I am thankful for that low moment, even though it was really hard to go through at the time.
I love those stories, and I'm sure you've read many of them from authors like Joe Bowler and Carol Dweck, others who specialize more in the math field than, say, a Carol Dweck. But this idea that we come to math, or we come to math education sometimes unwillingly, as you did, and I have to say, your story resonates so closely with mine that it's scary. And we find ourselves having this tremendous responsibility. And suddenly realizing, wow, I don't have the tools that I thought I had or I imagined I would need. And so let's take a much, much deeper look at this thing. I remember being in exactly the same position that you described probably 10 years ago and realizing at the front of an eighth grade math classroom, I don't really know how to properly teach linear equations. And here I am struggling. I felt like I understood it. I didn't completely. And here I am struggling to teach it. And one of the best ways and sort of rethinking my entire practice, although I have to say you've gone a whole lot deeper than I ever did. So my hat goes off to you for that. And that's why you're on the show today, Melissa, looking to learn more. In your book, Melissa, Unravel School, you say that to reset education as we know it, we must start at the key thread, assessment and evaluation. Why does it all start there?
Such a good question, because I do think there's lots of things that we need to pull at when it comes to the school system and school as it stands and our understanding of learning and teaching. But what I've come to realize in the last 20 years, particularly in the last sort of 10, sort of second half of my career so far, and I realized that what we believe about assessment and its purpose and how it works really informs the instructional decisions we make in our classroom. If we believe that assessment is about growth and feedback and learning, the learning side of things, then that changes the way we plan for learning to happen in our classroom, because it means that we're looking at learning in a different way. When I was younger in my career, and unwittingly was following the traditional grading system, because that's what I knew, right? We teach the way we were taught and we grade the way we were graded. Mm-hmm. I was doing that and realizing, like, even if I was using backwards design, my plan was still thinking about, well, how am I going to get a grade out of this learning? And so even in my backwards design understanding and essential questions and all of that good work, my focus was on, well, how do I get a grade at the end? And so then that informed the way I was planning and developing tasks for my class, because at the end of the day, I was thinking, like, well, I have to get a grade. If we shift our thinking towards understanding assessment as a holistic process, as something we do with our students, not to them, because we do really well at doing stuff to our students. If we understand assessment as being what we do with our learners, then that's going to influence the way we plan instructional learning experiences for our students, because our goal is not, how am I going to grade? Am I going to get a grade at the end? Our goal is, how are we going to help our learners change their brains as they interact with this learning, with this material that we're sharing with them? I really believe, you know, especially, I think it's something we have to keep in mind, especially right now for myself as a secondary educator right now. I'm hesitant to use the words, I'm a math teacher, I'm a science teacher, I'm an ELA teacher. I'm actually a teacher of people, and the content I use happens to be math and science and ELA. And when we make that switch in our heads, and we make our switch around assessment and evaluation as well, then it's a subtle mind shift. It's even the shift between talking about using the word grading and using the word assessment. It seems like a subtle shift, but when we make that shift in our brains, it does impact the way we make decisions for our learners. And so I really think that in order for us to see change at really a deep level in schooling, we have to peel back all the layers to what's our real end goal. And oftentimes our end goal is, well, I have to have a mark on the report card. Even in ungrading situations, if we're a teacher who is, you know, following ungrading or going gradeless, it's still at this point in time, unless we're working in a very alternative setting, I got to have a mark on the report card. But we have to peel it back to the layers, the deepest root. And so I think starting at assessment, really understanding what we believe about that, really impacts everything that we do. And unfortunately, as some others have stated, it's the elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about. I love to talk about assessment. It's my favorite thing. My colleagues know that about me. They're like, don't talk, you know, Melissa's going to talk about assessment. If you say anything about it to her, she's going to bring it up. But it's an elephant in the room for a lot of educators. We're willing to talk about instructional practices, and we're willing to reimagine our classroom environment. And we're really willing to think about, you know, the placement of the desks and what technology we use. But ask teachers to sit down and have a hard conversation about grading and grades. Nobody wants to have that conversation. It's very personal. It's very controversial, as anybody who follows, you know, anything on Education X like knows. If we're not arguing about direct instruction or inquiry-based instruction, we're arguing about grades and what their purpose is. So being willing to have those conversations, those hard conversations about assessment, is where we need to start.
I resonate with everything that you just said there as well, Melissa, and I agree. I think assessment underlines everything we do, every decision we make in the education context. You talk about assessment practices and philosophies being precious and sacred to teachers. I think few topics are more emotional. I talk with my friend Tom Shimmer, who is an author and speaker at Solution Tree on assessment, and I think sometimes about all of the angst and the hostility, I'll use that word, that he faces sometimes from teachers who say, don't take away my penalties, don't take away my system, my point system. Don't take away this precious leverage that I have that I use to exert compliance or illicit compliance from my students. And all of this is like existential for teachers because it is what they've built their practice on in some cases for decades. I remember when the pandemic hit and this idea that some states and jurisdictions were not going to be grading students. And the question quickly became, well, how can we make them work? How can we make them do anything? And that's a whole other conversation, I suppose. So you've already spoken a little bit to this, but I wonder if you could add anything to this question. I mean, I have it here in my lineup and I think it's an important one. Can you go a little deeper on this distinction between grading and assessment?
Yeah, I love that people sort of float around this idea that like grading is for eggs and for diamonds and not for students. I think we've really like touched on some of it already. Like grading is so, especially traditional, when we think about like traditional grading, penalties, points, rewards, marks, half marks, percentages, numbers, it's so ingrained in the teaching profession. But it's really, it's not about, in my experience, in my thinking about it, and as I've learned more and read more, I have like, if you could see my desk, I'm surrounded by books about assessment, pretty much. The more I learn about it and the more I really think about what's the goal of what we do with our learners. And in my mind, our goal is to help them grow. Our goal is to help them become better human beings. Yes, that's and I get some pushback on that and hear like, well, isn't that the parent's job? It's our job to teach them the content. But I actually think it's very ingrained. I think we spend so much time and have so much, whether we want to admit it or not, and whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, we have so much influence over the young people we have in our lives. We're going to make an impact on them. It might be not a good one, but you're going to make an impact. I think that's something we have to keep in mind as we walk into our classrooms every day.
I mentioned Tom a moment ago, and he really helped me with this question of grading and assessment, because for a while I got really caught up in the conversation of gradeless, going gradeless. There's a movement out there in Education X, or a hashtag, you'll see that around, going gradeless. And he said, well, Tim, we're still grading work. It's still important to grade work in the technical sense of grading. And you used a couple of great analogies. I haven't heard the diamonds one in a while, but it makes perfect sense. If we're looking at eggs, diamonds, apples, whatever it might be, it's helpful to be able to grade quality. And it's helpful to us. It's helpful to shoppers. It's helpful to vendors, whatever, you know, apply the metaphor. But so when it comes to our students, they need to have that feedback. That's very helpful feedback for them. What we're getting at in some cases, I suppose, and I think you're familiar with the British Columbian K-9 system. We're not using percentages or letter grades or, frankly, numbers anywhere in our assessment, but we're still grading on a proficiency scale. And that is important. We don't want to take this idea of suddenly we're completely non-critical, right? out of the feedback process. That's not helpful. Absolutely. To students either. And so we're not putting grading in the doghouse. We're not saying grading is bad, but we can look at what's our system, what's our structure, what's the best way to convey that to students. Your latest post on the Learning Lab at deanofmath.wordpress.com, highly recommend subscribing, dear viewer and listener, was titled, Are We About Tasks or Are We About Learning? Mm-hmm. And a lot of teachers, I think, Melissa, would read that and think, well, aren't they one and the same? Aren't we doing the same thing? So we've got another distinction here that I swear is not just about semantics. These are very important distinctions. Do you think that a lot of schools are unclear on the mission of school right now?
Yeah, I think coming out of the pandemic, particularly when we had to move online for most of us, I know like my experience for a long time in the classroom has been, well, I just have to get them to do this checklist of things. And if they do this checklist of tasks, then that means they've learned something.
Right.
But ultimately, just doing a checklist of tasks, I don't actually think it always leads to learning. I think it leads to completion, and I think it can lead to a sometimes surface level of understanding. But when I think about the distinction between doing tasks and actually learning, I always come back to thinking about learning in my mind means our students are coming away changed in some fundamental way. Does doing the task change my students in a fundamental way? And I think we are so focused on the number of tasks, they've done all the assignments, that means they're good to go, they get the grade, they pass the course, they get the credit. We boil it down to like, well, how many more assignments do I need to do in order to get this credit? Or, you know, how many tasks is it do I need to have done at this percentage to get an A, for example? I think we need to take a step back and think about like, what really is our goal? Because learning shows up in so many different ways that doesn't have a task associated with it. And our challenge is, how do we make that learning visible without always relying on, here's a thing I need you to do and check off the checklist? So I'm really spending a lot of time reflecting on and thinking about that, making thinking and learning visible in ways that's different than just giving an assignment and having them do the assignment. Because it's a very fine line, and it's hard to tease the two of them out. But when we think about, what's my goal ultimately? Just doing the things doesn't always translate into my goal of my students coming away with a deeper understanding of something. So I think we've lost sight of that a little bit, coming out of, you know, a variety of changes and thinking about, you know, having to teach online and doing online learning, and here's your Google Classroom or your learning management system, and here's all the assignments you have to do. I think learning needs to have some other component to it. And when we focus on just getting kids to through the tasks, it kind of feels like hoops to jump through. We end up with this notion of kind of perceived success. They did all the tasks, that means they're successful. Well, what are they successful at? And I think it comes down to like are they being compliant and wrote and they've memorized the information and they're sending it back to you? So one of the lines that, and it doesn't directly line in here, but one of the things I always think about is, you know, I don't know that we're assessing what we think we're assessing when we have kids do tasks. So I think we need to take a step back and really try to separate out learning from just a list of things that kids need to do.
This conversation is so critical. I mean, they all are, but when parents ask us as teachers, how is my child doing? Mm-hmm. Our belief about this question right here, the difference between tasks and learning, is going to shape the way we respond. So yeah. Traditionally, teachers might have said, well, Johnny's completed assignment 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. He's handing everything in and he's checking all the boxes.
Yeah.
That answer says zero about Johnny's proficiency, understanding, skills. It says that he's compliant and he's doing the work.
Yeah.
And presumably, it's sort of implied in that answer is that he has a certain level of competence. I'll say that.
Yeah.
But it doesn't say a whole lot about, well, what is he actually learning, right? And so that's where my mind goes to learning targets. And I think, well, he just completed a compare and contrast report or presentation of some kind. What was the learning target? What was the curricular standard? Mm-hmm. And let's zero in on that. Flesh out the criteria of what that looks like or what proficiency looks like, and then start to address, is he where he needs to be on that particular curricular learning standard? And then now we're starting to actually put some definition to his progress, right?
Absolutely.
If he's just because he's completing all of the work, it's sort of separating quality and quantity, right?
Yes.
And it comes back to the distinction as well. When I come to a classroom, and I have the privilege occasionally of, as a part-time administrator, visiting different classrooms and checking in on students around my building. And the dream is when you ask a student, what are you learning? If they can actually articulate some version of the learning target, that's the dream.
Yes.
A more common question and answer there is, what are you doing? And then the student says, oh, I'm making this poster. Great. you know, that's a good task. And it looks like you're making a math poster about fractions. Okay, great. But what are you learning? And that starts to unpack the difference as well. Thank you for joining us for this conversation, Teachers on Fire. If you're getting value here, give this video a like wherever you are tuning in. Melissa, what are some small steps that teachers can take in terms of their assessment practices in order to better support student growth, particularly in the math and science classrooms?
That's such a good question, because I think so much of what's out there and the people that I have conversations with tend to be more focused in the humanities. And I think it's been a bit of an easier switch to start thinking about reimagining assessment in the humanities classrooms. And as someone who also teaches ELA and in social sciences, having those conversations is a little bit easier because it's been, you know, the grading practices in an ELA classroom, for example, are a little, they do look different than a math and a science classroom. The biggest small step that I think you can make in a math classroom and in a science classroom when it comes to your assessment practices is really shifting your lens from cataloging what students can't do and thinking about what can they do. Having an asset-minded approach to how we assess has a huge, it's a small shift in language, but it is a huge change in perspective on the purpose of assessment and how it works. So when I switched from thinking about my math students as, oh, they can't add fractions, that was like my phrase. You know, if I built a rubric, because I do think using a rubric and other tools in math classrooms is something that we need to start, that is also a place to start. But if I built my criteria level as, well, they can't add fractions. Well, what can they actually do? Like, can they make equivalent fractions? Can they add fractions with common denominators? Is it the unlike denominators that's the problem, where they're getting stuck? Viewing assessment as what can they do and where have they gotten stuck, rather than just, oh, they can't do this. They can't do this. They made this mistake. They got this question wrong. It's not helpful for the student to just be like, here's a catalog of things that you did incorrectly. And it's not helpful for us as the lead learner in the room to think about, well, where do we go next? If all we've sat down and thought about is what they can't do. If we can sit down and make a list of, you know, after going through a math test, or going through an assignment, going through some sort of learning experience, and highlighting for ourselves, well, what can they do? Where do they need to go next? And how are they going to get there? Which I think is the three big questions we always need to be asking ourselves with respect to assessment. Making that shift, that's where I started, and it has a trickle effect. Once you start thinking about what they can do and not what they can't do, we spend so much time focusing on teaching growth mindset, especially in mathematics. I can't do it yet, right? We focus right. So much
on the power of yet.
The power of yet, right? But then we go, okay, the power of yet, but here's your math test back, and I just circled all the things you did wrong.
And we're moving on.
Yeah. So building in that time, I especially think, whether it's you having your students go through a math test after the fact and doing corrections, or having a conference, or sitting in a small group and unpacking some of the questions, like using those pieces as part of the learning journey and not just, it's the end of the math unit, here's your math test, you got 67 out of 82, now we're moving to the next unit, which happens a great deal. It doesn't benefit the learner and doesn't benefit me as a teacher, because I'm like, well, I don't know what to do next, really. Okay, I'll just move to the next textbook chapter. We have to shift it towards what they can do, and then letting that guide our instruction practices.
Mm. So good. Thinking about inquiry-based learning, we're all on board with the concept, I think. I've been following Trevor McKenzie. I'm sure you're familiar with his work. Yeah. And there's so much life in it. There's so much potential and promise, I think, in terms of activating student agency. But Melissa, when it comes to inquiry-based learning, I think the teachers that get the most nervous in all of K-12 education are the upper-level math teachers. And so let's talk about them. They feel these pressures to, quote, cover the whole curriculum. And I put that in quotes because it means different things to different people. But cover the whole curriculum because, God forbid, I send my student from grade 10 into grade 11 missing some things, right, that is going to set them behind when it comes to critical university entrance kinds of courses. So how do you think this through? I'm so fascinated by the idea that you are integrating inquiry-based learning practices into these classes or courses, or do you feel this tension as well?
Absolutely. And I have that because I do wear a lot of hats. I teach 11th grade biology, and I teach in a grade 10 interdisciplinary classroom where I teach science, ELA, and social studies all together, where I have been able to dabble in the inquiry in those settings. But I'm also super passionate about, like, all the really good things about inquiry-based learning that, you know, that Trevor talks about. I have absorbed all of his books, and John Spencer and AJ Giuliani and project-based learning and design thinking. All of those things, I think, when I think about what math class could be like, I just see it thriving and flourishing in those environments so greatly. And as a young teacher, a young math teacher, when I taught 7th and 8th grade for a long time teaching math, I encountered the same thing. People are like, I have to cover all the content. I don't have time for project-based learning in math class. I don't have time for inquiry-based learning in my math class. I got to cover all the content. I actually started finding, when I switched my mindset to making my math class not just about inquiry-based learning, but also pulling in this notion that math is not a set of discrete linear units we have to teach, but rather a group of overarching concepts that our students need to come away with. I actually found that I covered the content significantly more efficiently, because instead of just chunking through and going through the textbook or going through, like, making math into a checklist of things, discrete skills that they could do, stepping back to my curriculum and thinking about what are the patterns, because I ultimately believe math is about pattern finding and pattern making. What are the patterns in the content? How can I group them together into this experience where students are involving themselves in asking the questions? And then, you know, like, my favorite question to ask in a math class is, like, what do you notice? What do you wonder? What's your question about this? You know, here's a problem. What do we know? What don't we know? Where do we want to go with this? Giving them that opportunity allows them to explore a variety of concepts at the same time in a connected context that allows you to make sure, if at the same time you're thinking, I have to cover all of these different things, doing it in a way that allows kids the freedom to bring in learning from other units of study helps it helps relieve that pressure. I have found, in my experience, has been, and as I talk to other educators in upper math class too, as they sort of start to thinking about opening up their classrooms to an inquiry mindset, and I have to state that inquiry math is not about students just blindly discovering mathematics. It's about an intentionally crafted experience with mathematics that also involves direct instruction at the right time. Because I think there's a misconception about inquiry-based learning in general, but also about particularly inquiry-based learning in the math classroom, that it's somehow about students just, here you go, here's some problems, try and solve them. It's not really about that. It's really about an intentionally crafted learning experience with the math that engages learners in a different way. It does open things up, and it can make it more efficient. It can be more holistic. And ultimately, at the end of the day, when they've had this experience, then they go on to the next level with this deeper base of actual conceptual understanding of what the mathematics really is. That's been my experience.
I know one of my past guests, Phil Stringer, I don't know if you caught that episode, Melissa, but he's based here in Vancouver, and he would agree with the way you just characterized the efficiency of teaching math more from a global perspective, not global, I think you under universal, the words are escaping me, but overarching concepts, right? Instead of subdividing math into 9 different units, like one unit per month as math is traditionally or conventionally taught. So I think there is a lot of efficiency. And once you achieve that efficiency, it gives you a little bit of breathing room to speak to that anxiety that some teachers experience about covering the curriculum. Now you can have some freedoms to allow for a little more student agency and choice than perhaps we are used to allowing students in the math classroom.
Yes. Yeah.
One thing I want to address is that it somehow become, this is your quote. Okay. So you wrote, "One thing I need to address is that it somehow becomes socially and academically acceptable to do nothing in a classroom." And I think you had a little more to say that I couldn't fit in here, but I thought, wow, that's packing a bit of a punch. So say more about that quote. What do you mean by acceptable to do nothing in a classroom? Are you talking about from a student perspective, a teacher perspective, or both? And how can we create cultures of mastery in our classrooms?
Yeah, this is something I've been thinking about. That tweet that you mentioned, that's very recent. That's from a few days ago. I spent a lot of time in my classrooms observing and learning from my students, and I document that. I have, again, like I have like 25,000 notebooks kicking around my house and in my classroom. I spent a lot of time observing my learners when I'm not actively engaged in direct, you know, explicit instruction or monitoring the room or talking or feedback. I try to spend a little bit of time observing. And I have noticed, and it maybe it's just particular to my group of students, but I don't think it is, that there is a group of students who, I love them all dearly, but who spend most of their time, if I just observe them, they're doing nothing. And there's no immediate pushback on that. Certainly the pressure to do something or to be engaged in learning, to be doing something is going to come from me if I walk over and say, "Hey, we need to be doing something right now," or what are you learning about, or what are you engaged in? But it is, there's not... And this is going to make me sound maybe like, oh, back in my day, there was not this freedom to just, like, I remember being in a classroom, like, and if you weren't doing what you had been asked to do or engaged in what the rest of the students were engaged in, there was this sort of external, like, people were going to notice that you aren't doing what you're supposed to be doing. And there was a sense of, like, not pressure, but... It was more unacceptable, and there's so many layers to this, right? Like, well, grading and compliance and things, but students are not coming into the room with this mindset of I am here to engage in and become a master of my own learning. I'm here to put in my time, and if I put in enough time, then I'm gonna pass. I'm gonna be successful, right? Like, we see this with the transition of students from grade 8 to grade 9, where all of a sudden, you know, in the systems that I work in middle school, elementary school, if you don't meet the expectations of the curriculum, you still move on. And then we hit 9th grade, and if you don't meet the expectations of the curriculum, you redo the credit. But they're coming in with this mindset of like, well, what do you mean? Like, I'm here. I'm in the room. I came to class. Isn't that enough? What that's sort of become acceptable practice and thought. So I'm trying to unpack for myself and for my learners, like, how do we build a culture where the purpose of coming to the school, the purpose of entering the learning space is for learning, and that nobody would feel like, well, failing is an option. Well, I'll just fail, or I'll redo my credit, or like, why is that an option for students? And I'm doing a terrible job of explaining this one, I believe.
No, not at all.
Because I'm still wrestling through so much of it in my head. But how do we develop this space where nobody feels And we don't want like compliant taskmaster pressure. We want this sense of like internal desire to come into the space and be engaged and learn and grow. How do I develop a culture where that is the purpose? And is it possible where we're in a system where kids are there because they are told they have to, right? Nobody comes into my grade. Well, I think there's a few kids, but in general, nobody's coming to grade 9 math because they woke up that day and thought, what do I want to do today? I would love to go to a grade 9 math classroom. They're there because they have to be there. But how do we then make our spaces places where that also is paired with a sense of, yes, I have to be here, but also I'm going to give the best of me to this space because that's what we do here. So I don't have an answer, but I have lots of wonderings.
So good. I think a lot of it comes down to ownership. Are they owning the learning experience? And that speaks to hunger and appetite and motivation. And you're right. There's so much that we could say about this. Part of it, my mind also goes to the work of Dr. Peter Liljedahl and the idea of defronting the classroom and getting students standing and engaged with each other at non-permanent vertical surfaces. I know you're familiar with that work. Mm. And so that goes a long way to eliminating passengers from the learning environment or spectators. Yeah. But you're also asking it from I hear more from the perspective of the student experience. Mm-hmm. You know, what is their, how can we change their approach, their mindset? And so simply throwing an instructional practice out there isn't a complete answer either. Great question. Love it. We could talk for hours about that one. Yeah. If you're enjoying this conversation, teachers, consider adding the Teachers on Fire YouTube channel to your morning commute. Start your day on fire. Let's start to shift gears, Melissa, and dig into you as a person. Tell us, what's another area of learning for you? What is it that ignites your passions outside of these classrooms and brings you alive as a human being?
Oh, that's such a big question. I have so many different things I would say about that. I think the passion that most fuels me right now is on the weekends. Typically, I bake bread and enjoy sharing that with other people. I started baking bread as a bucket list item before the pandemic, before it was cool for everybody else to also bake bread. And doing that is something, the process of it, the steps, especially making sourdough bread, the steps involved and the time investment and the joy that something so simple can bring people is just such a soul enriching experience for me to put in the work and then share that with other people, if you know, whether that's my family or it's my colleagues or my neighbors. That's an area of interest and learning. I'm constantly learning about that. And I think outside the classroom too, the thing that brings me most alive, and aside from that, which is, and this is still maybe connected to the classroom a little bit, but is writing. I spend a lot of time journaling. I spend a lot of time walking and reflecting on things and then writing them down. That's why I have my blog. It's why I am surrounded by notebooks. The process of putting words into writing, that is something that fuels me and helps with, you know, when we think about like teacher burnout and teacher levels of exhaustion, for me, taking time out of my day to sit down for 10 minutes to write something down that I've thought about or reflected on and experienced with, you know, my students or with my family or just myself, learning about that process, the writing process, and how we put our thoughts into something concrete is very fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm. Melissa, we have to figure out a way to be able to lower our teaching percentage, maintain our current compensation percentage, but allow for more writing time, I think would just be the perfect mix if we could figure out how to make that happen. All right, now we're getting into the rapid fire. I have so enjoyed this conversation, Melissa. I'm speaking way more than I should be, but these topics are so juicy and close to my heart as well. So I feel like I'm with a soulmate here when it comes to assessment and learning. I'll start to limit my answers as much as I can, but I'd love to hear from you as we start to land the plane. Share about a personal habit or a productivity hack that contributes to your success and keeps your fire burning. You're such a thinker. You're such a writer, reflector of your practice. Mm-hmm. How do you fit it all in?
The short answer is, and not everyone loves this answer, the short answer is I get up early in the morning. And the first thing I do is I go for a walk. It doesn't matter what the weather is. And, you know, I live in, if the listeners are familiar with Manitoba, Canada, it's not pretty weather here all the time. But I get up and I go for a walk. And that gives me space to start my day. It gives me space to think about some things. I'm a big proponent of the need for space and walking and journaling, as per Ryan Holiday, who is very big in, he talks about stoicism a lot, but one of the practices he talks about a lot is the importance of journaling and the importance of walking. And since I've incorporated those two things into my life, I feel much more, there's a sense of, it keeps my fire burning, gives me time to think, gives me space, gives me some time to write things down when I come back. Starting your day with exercise and fresh air. I've never been for a walk first thing in the morning and thought, gosh, I really wish I didn't do that. I have had lots of days where I haven't done it and gone, gosh, I wish I'd gone for my 15-minute walk this morning. So that has been I just started doing that recently, and that has made a big difference for me.
Tell us about someone that we need to follow on Education X, Instagram, or LinkedIn and share why they've been inspiring you lately.
There's so many people I could mention, and Tyler Rablin is one for sure. I know he was on your show not that long ago. The person that most first came to mind, though, that is really doing the work in the space that I also think is coming on your show shortly, too, is Natalie Vardabasso. She's on Twitter. And that is somebody who is really impactful for me. And the other person I would throw out there in a whole different vein is Jessica Vance on both Instagram and Education X. She's about inquiry and learning walls and using a lens of inquiry in our leadership practices. And that is something that both as a teacher using inquiry in my classroom and making thinking visible is really important to me, but also as somebody who is a aspiring and unofficial leader in the classroom space and in my classroom, you know, my building, leading with the lens of inquiry is really important. So I've been learning a lot from them recently.
Point us to an ed tech tool that you currently love using in your professional practice.
This pen right here.
Okay.
There's a lot of like really great ed tech things out there, but I have dabbled in a lot of them. But I'm actually currently finding that the most thing that I love most in my practice right now is the practice of writing with paper and pencil and having my students go back to paper and pencil. And for me, writing things out, making that connection between hand and brain. I think those technologies are things that I'm really focused on right now.
Recommend one book, one that you've been reading lately or one of your all-time faves, and tell us why you recommend it.
The book that started everything for me as a math educator in the space of reimagining math is The Pie of Life by Sunil Singh. And that was the first book I read that really helped me see that mathematics is and should be and could be something entirely different from what I had experienced as a student, and therefore really ignited my own personal journey on understanding mathematics in a new way. So whenever people ask me about where to start as a math educator, reimagining what mathematics is, that's the book I always send people to.
As a support to my work here, Melissa, who is one educator that you would recommend I interview next on the Teachers on Fire podcast?
I think if you haven't talked to Monty Seary yet, he is very big in the same kinds of things as myself, but much, much bigger scale. He is somebody who is deep, deep in the work of reimagining what learning is really all about. He's an ELA teacher, and has done a lot of deep dives into the purpose of schooling and the purpose of education, and he always makes me think. So he would be a great guest.
Just for fun, what are you streaming during your downtime, Melissa, when you've got no brain power left for anything productive? What's going on Netflix or Prime or whatever platform you happen to be viewing on?
I don't do a lot of my downtime tends to be reading more than TV watching. But my favorite thing that I always ask people about is Yellowstone and the Yellowstone prequels, 1883 and 1923. Those are all three of those shows are thought provoking and dramatic and impactful and just is something that I love to turn to.
I have never tuned in, so I will add that to my to watch list. What are the best ways? And actually, just before I ask this question, Melissa, could you say a little bit about the book and your mission there? Why did you write it? Who is it for?
Yeah, so this is a copy. I have a copy here. It's called Unravel School, Reimagine Classrooms, Reinvent Assessment, and Revive Learning. And the purpose of me writing that book, it's part memoir, part the same kinds of things I tend to tweet and blog about, my reflections on a whole variety of kind of like thinking, the start of my journey of rethinking what learning could look like in a classroom across curriculum areas and grades, I think. So my purpose in writing that and the purpose of me writing my blog and what I put on Twitter, X and Instagram is my goal is to get people thinking. And so I feel that I have done something successful with my day if I've tweeted something that somebody came back at me and said, I have never thought about this. What are you talking about? I disagree. Like, let's have a debate and discussion. Like, I love to just have people stop and think about the why behind what they're doing. And so that's the purpose in writing that I had for that book. And the purpose that I have for upcoming writing projects and for my blog is just to help people sort of spark some thinking and maybe some disagreement, and that's totally fine. I would love to have discourse on Twitter. I'm definitely not one of those people who just tweets and then doesn't engage. I love to hear from differing viewpoints as well. So that's always my purpose, like something that for other people to think about.
I mentioned at the top of the program some of the ways that listeners could connect with you. Could you share those ways one more time? What are the best places for people who are interested in your message and the ideas you've shared here today? What are the best ways for them to connect with you online?
The best way is the place where I'm most active is X. So Dean_of_math. I also am active on Instagram in a little slightly different way. And Twitter is definitely the best place. I respond to the DMs. I love to have conversation with people. So definitely if you want to have a chat with me, reaching out through direct message or sending me a tweet is definitely the best place to do that.
I love that you haven't given up on Twitter, Melissa. Thanks for holding your ground and putting out great content. And educator, if you're in an environment where you feel like I've got this fire and not a whole lot of fellow embers fellow kindling around me, there is such an opportunity out there to connect with other educators. And Melissa's a great person to start with. So thank you again, Melissa. This conversation has been a realized dream because I've been following you for quite some time, reading your blog posts with interest and really inspired by your work. So thank you so much for sharing your time with the podcast today. This has been fun and inspiring for me. Teachers on Fire, I'm your host, Tim Cavey, and I'm so grateful that you decided to spend some of your day tuning in by video, perhaps, or listening to this audio-only experience of the podcast. I hope that in some way the content you heard today from Melissa Dean sparked your thinking and ignited your practice. And I'll meet you next week right back here, same time, same place, on the Teachers on Fire podcast. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye. Even when you feel slow, you can still go. Even when there's no hope, you can still go. I never answer to no, man, I still go.